Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski, and I got my co-host, Dr. Carl Nadolski Jr.
Hey,
and with us today, and I always say we have a special guest, but this is an extra special guest. We got Dr. Jonathan Brueger, a retina specialist, ophthalmologist, who is coming to us because there is a big report out about semaglutide and GLP-1s, although the study is specifically semaglutide.
Ozempic, Wegovy.
Causing a type of vision loss, big headlines about this. And we wanted to get a specialist on who happens to be my brother's old roommate.
In the Navy.
So
and he is a doc who lifts.
Yeah, so
we absolutely, and we have some stories about that, depending on how bored we want to make people, but they are entertaining.
Yeah, so Dr. Brueger, why don't you give us a quick little background of your training? You obviously went through the naval program and somehow ended up as my brother's roommate.
Great. So ultimately, went through med school, and then for internship into the Navy, I got linked up with Casey. Right, as far as a roommate, never met before, and then just showed up on this doorstep with my U-Haul and said, "Here I am." So we moved in,
and it was magical.
It was very magical. Became awesome friends, and ultimately Casey was in my wedding as well. So that's how much of a relationship we formed. But after our internship year together, went off with the Navy divers as a dive doctor, and after that, I earned my MBA during that time using Navy scholarships. So I went off to New York Eye and Ear in Manhattan to get my comprehensive ophthalmology training. Back to the Navy to do cataracts and just LASIK and PRK and refractive surgery. And ultimately left the Navy to go do my retina training with the world famous Steve Charles. And since that time, I've been in practice doing retina surgery for the past 4 years.
Oh.
Holy cow.
Now, I don't know if we told this story yet, but
we do have a story. We tell a story about you every once in a while.
I'm pretty sure we told this, but this is the same guy. When I was a medical student, a third year, my first rotation was surgery. And
somehow we hooked you up with doing it at the Naval Hospital.
I was doing it at the Navy. I was not a Navy. These two guys were Navy doctors, and I was just a third year medical student. In medical school, you start off in the classroom, and then you go do clinicals, although now they're kind of mixing both.
And by this point, I was a second-year resident, right?
Yeah.
And Brueger was still around.
Yeah, so I'm nervous. It's my first time going in, and surgery is, like, tough. At the Navy, they can be kind of mean. So Brueger says, here's a tip. You're going to start off on colorectal. So, like, when you go in, these people are under anesthesia, and they're going to ask you to do a prostate exam on the guys, because it's the best time you can actually do it. They're under anesthesia. They won't even know. So you get a good feel of their prostate. And since they're under, you can actually use two fingers to get a really good feel on the prostate
exam. This is what Dr. Brueger, who we're talking to right now, was telling Spencer, the third year medical student.
So I was like, okay. I was like, I don't know. I'm a third year medical student. And I've never scrubbed into any surgery. So it's very intimidating because I'm like a bull in a china shop. I'm kind of a bigger guy, and I'm around the scrub.
Very uncoordinated.
The nurses and everything who are all scrubbed in, the doctor. And before the surgery, I'd actually went up to the patient and said, "Hey, you know, I'm a med student. Nice to meet you. You're supposed to introduce yourself, get a permission to do the prostate exam." And I was like, "You're going to be under. Is it okay if I do a prostate exam?" Sure, fine, whatever. So I'm scrubbed in, which is the first time I've ever scrubbed in. I've been on surgeries, watched them, but never actually scrubbed in. It's very nerve-wracking your first time because you're not supposed to touch anything. You have to keep your hands where they can see you so that you don't contaminate the
field. Very intense.
So the colorectal surgeon, very intimidating, goes, "All right, med student, go do the prostate exam." And I go, and I just, like, for some reason, I thought to myself, is this, do I really need to use two fingers? But I just want to make sure. Two fingers, right? And it was almost like a record stop in the whole room. And everybody looked at me, and the surgeon just looked at me puzzled. He goes, dude, you're fucking sick. And I go, ha, 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 ha. Ah, just kidding. And so I was like, oh my God, I would have put two fingers. I had no idea. So I come back and I was like, Brugger, why'd you tell me two fingers? He goes, I thought you knew I was joking. I go, I didn't know what I was doing. I know nothing. Why would I know you were joking? It's like, because it was clearly ridiculous. I go, but I don't even know what I'm doing.
Oh my God.
So that's the story.
That's the Brugger story that gets told every once in a while.
I had no idea. Time, but that sounds like me.
So
yeah, two fingers, right, for sure.
So let's get it. Okay, first of all, this study comes out, and these things make headlines because these GLP-1 medicines are just so hot. And we talk about it every single podcast almost. Can you tell us what this is? What is? Because a specific type of vision loss.
Yeah, non-arteritic anterior ischemic optic neuropathy. Yeah, good Lord. People haven't heard of this.
Non-arteritic ischemic optic neuropathy. So NAION. We don't call it NANON or whatever. It's NAION. So NAION is basically where the blood flow to the optic nerve is limited, and subsequently you stroke out the optic nerve. A typical symptom is when individuals wake up from sleep, one eye has of the vision gone. So let's say it's my right eye, either the top half or the bottom half of the vision is gone. And it's a perfect horizontal line straight through the vision, and everything either north or south of that is gone, simply because that's how the blood flow is to our retinas. The diagnosis of this, so we'll get called and say, hey, I had sudden vision loss, and these patients will come in, just anyone with NAION. And ultimately, we have various signs and symptoms that we kind of had on to make the diagnosis of exclusion. It's not really a hardcore, hey, there's a lab and we proved it. It's more of a constellation of things. First and foremost, often the optic nerve is what we call a disc at risk. So the optic disc, and it's very crowded. So all the vessels are pretty tight. And I think of it kind of like a too tight of a turtleneck, right? You don't want it too tight because it's going to cut off circulation. So often their optic nerve is pretty tight and all the blood vessels are crowded. Then there's three different things we look for. One is sleep apnea, or individuals, I'll ask if they snore a lot at sleep or if they stop breathing if they have a partner. That will drop your blood pressure at night. Number two is if they take blood pressure medicines before they go to bed, because that can drop your blood pressure at night. And then finally, we ask about hydration. If you're dehydrated, or if you were working really hard the day before, then your blood pressure could be too low at night, drop your perfusion, and that tight disc will squeeze around the vasculature, you'll lose blood flow to the optic nerve, and then at that point you lose half of your vision.
Holy cow. And so there are a lot of associations with this stemming from, say, obesity itself, right? So obesity complicated by sleep apnea, type 2 diabetes, and high cardiovascular risk, right, is a risk factor.
Absolutely.
From what I know. And so the patients, the type of people who are the ones who should be getting semaglutide and similar medications are the ones who have the highest risk. I mean, we talk about 85% of people with obesity and type 2 diabetes have sleep apnea. You know, they all have high blood pressure, so they're getting treated with blood pressure medications, while at the same time, we're trying to treat their obesity, lose the weight, nutrition, exercise, plus medicine that helps it do that, and low blood pressure. And that's what you're kind of saying, that drop in blood pressure overnight.
Yeah. If you have a drop overnight, that's the typical cause for this.
And that's why it's the morning.
And hence in the morning. So somewhere probably around 2 a.m., their blood pressure drops. They become apneic. Their late night blood pressure meds are kicking in. They're dehydrated, and they just don't perfuse the optic nerve. And ultimately, when I see these patients, I look and say, hey, there is a possibility of having what's called a sequential NAION. So the other eye could take a hit. So it becomes more important for me to adjust their blood pressure medicine and say, hey, we can't take it at night anymore. You need to take it in the morning. We need to get sleep apnea study. And we have to look at potentially losing weight, because that is the sleep apnea correlation typically.
So in generally, I mean, it sounds like we all have to do what we all say we have to do all the time anyways, and really try to prevent this, the risk factors right. from causing this. I mean,
I was trying to look up what the difference is between non-arteriotic, whatever.
Yada, yada, yada.
From actual...
Arteriotic.
Arteriotic, and it talks about... Yeah, so it talks about giant cell arteritis and inflammation, but this is non-inflammatory.
Correct. This is non-inflammatory. So AION is a full-blown stroke, typically. AION, we often associate with, like you said, giant cell arteritis or GCA, and that is an inflammatory condition against the elastin of the musculature.
Okay.
That typically will present as the whole eye going like light perception. So they'll have a central retinal artery occlusion typically in their eye, or the nerve took a full hit. And that is that the blood flow from the artery has been completely limited.
All right. So before we get to what this study was about, we have to take a slight break, apparently, for these ads that the podcast platform needs. So here's our break. Moment of silence for the sponsors. All right. Godspeed.
All right. Wait. So, okay. First thing I want to know, just before we get into how the study was done and whatever, is this known now amongst eye doctors, ophthalmologists, that like, hey, we're starting to see this? Is this why they looked into this? Like, because you wouldn't even look into this unless somebody's anecdotally seeing a signal.
Well, they did say in their background that, hey, there have been some anecdotal thoughts on this.
So, right.
What's your anecdote?
I'm sure some of the neuro-ophthalmologists who might see this more are picking up on that. It's similar to how the retina specialists, we're picking up that all these GLP-1 inhibitors are causing rip-roaring diabetic retinopathy. That is on the FDA warnings for a lot of these drugs.
We'll talk about that at the end. There's some nuance to that I think we need to have.
And ultimately, this is something that's kind of recently poked this head up. And as we're trying to wrap our heads around it, I think we're all going to fall back, at least in my opinion, is falling back onto the cause of NAION, which if you're dropping a lot of weight and your blood pressure is dropping, but you're not adjusting your medication for your hypertension, or you're still taking them at night, you're going through a huge fluctuation. Where if diet and exercise, you have a kind of a slower decrease in your blood pressure. You know, with a gastric bypass, it's even more rapid. But what's the difference? With a gastric bypass, you have a lot of follow-up. You're seeing a lot of your surgeons, the next day, the next week, weekly for a while. You're being measured and monitored very closely because we know you're going through a rapid change. And I think here with these medications, you're somewhere in between. So it may fall upon the primary care providers to start monitoring that blood pressure a little bit more closely, to rein in some of those drugs more closely, or have home monitoring be a staple to primary care doctors, where we're like, hey, we need to monitor your blood pressure. Also, it wouldn't hurt. Remember I said there was a disc at risk? So this isn't going to happen to everyone. But anytime I see a patient with a very tight optic nerve, which is the optic disc, I warn people. I go, if you have blood pressure, don't take your medicine at night. Stay hydrated for bedtime. And ultimately, you know, if you snore, you need a sleep apnea test. So I try to get ahead of that curve because it's so devastating, and there's nothing we can do to bring that vision back.
Yeah. So you already bring up some. So there's biological plausibility right here. Everybody's like, what about these GLP-1s? Is it the receptors on the optic nerves and all these different things? But you bring up very like the simplest.
Yeah. More
answer,
obvious.
The more obvious, simple answer that actually causes this. And that makes sense to me, because even people can get nauseated and severe so much that they're vomiting. They get dehydrated. There may be something about the drugs that actually lower blood pressure beyond even that as well. So that makes sense to me.
Well, and also, you know, blood pressure is one of the earliest improvements of obesity-related disease when we treat the obesity. So we say to, you know, patients, hey, you're going to have to probably pull back blood pressure meds. This is treating the root issue of the blood pressure. So we probably need to be more aggressive and teach people, hey, when we're doing all these things, be ready to pull back those blood pressure meds, huh?
Right. And this is similar. So if if I felt there was a direct correlation with this medication, I would anticipate it would be probably on the front end. It would be interesting to look at the data as far as how long they were taking these medications.
We'll get into that, because basically what you see is that it's a precipitous drop and then there's no effect later, at least according to this retrospect. And we'll get into the nuances of how they did the study, because these studies, the way they do them, are highly problematic. However, having said that, I think what you bring up
makes some sense.
It makes some sense.
But we'll also talk about how the retinopathy signal from the Sustained 6, the big cardiovascular outcome trial with essentially Ozempic and type 2 diabetes, is where the first signal came from. So let's talk about this study. We'll try to describe it in as layman terms as we can. So these authors, they kind of quote unquote leverage data from their own institution's centralized clinical registry.
This was a registry within neuro-ophthalmology.
Yeah, it was a neuro-ophthalmologist registry.
So they're getting the patients that have these types of issues.
But so what they did, it was a retrospective, meaning they're looking back at the cohort data. And it was from December 1, 2017 through this past November 30, 2023. And this is where it gets kind of interesting. I mean, they had almost 17,000 patients without a history of NAION. So that's what they started with, right? And then to see if there was an association, they had these two groups. They had patients with type 2 diabetes diagnosis, and they had people with obesity or an overweight diagnosis, essentially. And then they defined each group by either semaglutide, which could be Ozempic, or, you know, there wasn't much time to do Wegovy, but they must have done that.
2021.
So only a couple years of that, but semaglutide exposure versus non-GLP-1 receptor agonist therapy for either diabetes or obesity, respectively. They tried to do all sorts of controls. So they tried to do propensity score matching, which I'm sure everyone listening knows what that means, against age, sex, high blood pressure, lipids, type 2 diabetes, the sleep apnea, and the coronary artery disease. This is where the statistics, I'm kind of a little confused about this. So we have almost 17,000 patients, and they said of those, 710 had type 2 diabetes, which is only like 4%, which is a lot lower than like the prevalence in the United States, which is like 12. You know, so that's one little nugget that I'm a little like, that's a little weird. And then, you know, of that, they had, you know, about 200 that were actually prescribed, in that case, what would have been Ozempic. And then 516 prescribed something else. So a lot more people were prescribed something other than Ozempic or GLP-1 receptor agonists. Average age was 59. It was kind of 50-50 female, male. And then they had almost 1,000 people classified as overweight or with obesity. So again,
that's a very small
percent. That's only 6%. And we, you know, it should be like 40-some percent if it were similar to the United States population. So anyways, they had a more predominant female population, which is relatively typical of weight reduction medications. In that, 361 of those were prescribed semaglutide, presumably Wegovy, but not necessarily. And then 618 were prescribed other ones. So anyways, in the population with type 2 diabetes, there were 17 NAION events that occurred in the semaglutide group versus 6 in the non-GLP-1 receptor anti-diabetes cohort. So that was like of all those numbers we just went through, it was basically over 8% versus 1.1%, which sounds like a huge absolute number. But again, I'm just a little confused by all these numbers that don't quite jive. And then in the other one, let's see. And then it said the cumulative incidence, was about 8.9 versus 1.8 respectively. And then in the population of patients who had the classifications of overweight or obesity, there were 20 NAION events in the semaglutide group versus 3 in the non-GLP-1 receptor agonist cohort, you know, so that was like a 6.5 versus 1%. So I don't know. I mean, that's what caused the headlines. It was retrospective, you know, kind of, I don't know, match cohorts. And I think, you know, Spencer, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that before Spencer goes into the, you know, some of the potential flaws and confounders with these types of data, because this is not a randomized controlled trial. I'll talk about you know, the, any signals of eye disease from the other trials that, that you brought up earlier.
Yeah. Any thoughts about that?
I mean, the retrospective, we all know this is to give people clues as to maybe where to start turning over rocks to see if there is an issue.
I don't think generating.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not too strong on some of those. Even some of the studies I'm involved with ophthalmology, there's a lot of retrospectives, and now we're doing the prospective to actually prove these things where you're like, hey, it suggests that let's go prove that with power and pulls.
Okay. Yeah, it's a little bit different. We talked about one of the studies that came out back in maybe November or something, looking at they did this with EMR data in the past. And we talked about the gastroparesis and the way that they diagnosed gastroparesis. At least in this, with the EMRs, they actually went back and confirmed with diagnosis criteria that they truly, in fact, had this NAION or didn't. So I think they did a better job with that. But I think the interesting thing is, you know, on Twitter, people are tearing this study apart. But I think we still need to be careful because, as Dr. Brueger said, there is biological plausibility, and it makes sense to me. I know that I've overseen tens of thousands of patients, not personally, but with other doctors in our clinic online. And we've seen this sometimes because, as Dr. Brueger said, there's the diabetic retinopathy issue, which we'll talk about. But there have been some patients who have gotten some vision loss, and the ophthalmologist was basically like, no, it was semaglutide. Yeah, we've seen this in the past. Extremely rare. I've never seen it personally, but I've had other clinicians see this.
But it sure makes more sense that it's like almost treating too well the other risk factors for it that then secondarily cause it, as opposed to a direct effect of the medicine, which again is mimicking our body's own natural hormones from our intestines. So, you know, I'm always very skeptical when we're using these hormones that are essentially like what we have. They're just obviously kind of higher potency and stuff.
When you look at the Kaplan-Meier curve, this is the curve that looks at the incidence of this disease versus the people that didn't take the semaglutide. There's a quick, and we can link the study in this podcast, but the graph is interesting. It looks like there's a quick incidence of it, and then basically at 12 months, it doesn't change. And then over 12 months is kind of where you see the weight loss. And maybe that makes sense. There are a lot of people on Twitter basically ripping this apart, as I said. They can't control for severity of type 2 diabetes. So the meaning, like, you know, we don't know if these were severely uncontrolled versus very well controlled.
Right.
People that get semaglutide
usually need more intensive
therapy. That's later on. It's later on in the disease process. It's also, you know, it's potential the people that are getting semaglutide, they may be seeing different clinicians who are referring more. I don't even, there's all sorts of what they call selection biases, people that are getting sent to these clinics more often. Lots of different biases potentially involved. And that's problematic with all retrospective EMR registry type of data. Having said that, again, I do think we need to take this seriously, and there's biological plausibility. I don't know if there's anything else. I mean, the selection bias and that stuff is kind of the standard stuff people were talking about on Twitter. I've been using this artificial intelligence thing called Claude, and I basically talk back and forth with it. These things are amazing, by the way. And it's actually came up with a lot of the similar points of what the people on Twitter came up with. And I just kind of asking a little bit more questions, but I think the biggest things are kind of the selection bias. There's some people are talking something about immortal time bias.
You ever heard of such a thing?
Have you ever heard of immortal time bias?
I wish we had immortal time bias.
Yeah. It's kind of because the way that they calculated the person time for the statistical analysis is when they got a prescription for semaglutide and for the non-GLP-1, but they can't actually confirm when they actually picked up the prescription. So there's a time period where, whether they included or not, where they would be considered immortal. And whether they adjusted for this or not, I don't know. Because the medicines all came out in 2017. If they prescribed for them, could they actually pick it up? All these different issues. And what they did was we can't tell based on the methods whether they included that time or not. So anyway, just some little nuances of how they do these retrospective studies and the issues involved there.
Well, let's, before we go on and talk about overall eye disease, and now the media talking about everyone's going blind by taking this. Wasn't there something else that people used to say caused guys to go blind? Oh, anyways. All right. So let's take another little
Bruger
pause.
Be blind as hell.
Let's. Okay. Another little pause for our platform to throw in some random platform ads. All right. So where the heck did the blindness thing even start? Why were people even looking into this? Well, so first of all, the retinopathy that maybe you can tell people what the heck that even is one of the primary concerns and complications from long-term high blood sugar. So type 1 diabetes, type 2 diabetes, that was one of the first microvascular complications in my world that was shown to be dramatically reduced when we have improved glycemic control or blood sugar control in people with type 1 and type 2 diabetes. And so it's very important when we talk about blood sugar control for all these types of patients. But when semaglutide in the form of Ozempic was first studied in its big trials, you know, there was not, I don't believe in the phase 3 trials for sugar control and weight and all that stuff, there was much of a signal. But when they did the big cardiovascular outcome trial called SUSTAIN, which had people with obesity, type 2 diabetes, either established heart disease or kidney disease, putting that really high risk, that was shown to dramatically reduce the risk of heart attacks, strokes, death from cardiovascular disease overall, driven mostly by stroke and heart attack reduction, by the way. But they did notice that diabetic retinopathy complications occurred in 3% in the Ozempic group and almost 2% in the placebo group. And this is what started to raise these concerns, because it wasn't really shown in all the other ones. But we did know from a long time ago that going from really poorly controlled high blood sugars, like especially in type 1 diabetes, who then dramatically like kind of have their come to Jesus moment and they improve everything and they go from an average sugar of 300 down to an average sugar of 150, that can exacerbate some of these things like retinopathy, also neuropathy for any of our patients listening out there. And so in that trial, most of the events occurred early in the trial, and people were attributing it to the magnitude and the rapidity of the rapidness of the reduction in average blood sugar levels, specifically in those who had pre-existing retinopathy. And 84% had pre-existing diabetic retinopathy in that study. So then just to kind of go forward with it. So that was Ozempic. That's what raised all the concerns. A lot of the meta-analyses of these types of medications show a hint of the retinopathy concern, seemingly driven from that study, from the Ozempic in heart disease and in kidney disease study. So the oral, the pill form of semaglutide called Rybelsus, in their big cardiovascular outcome trial, didn't really show a difference. It was a non-statistically significant balanced 7 versus 6.5% retinopathy. However, they excluded established proliferative retinopathy because of the SUSTAIN trial. So they were like, oh man, we better not give it to people who have like really established disease. And then in the FLOW trial recently published, this was in people with type 2 diabetes and diabetic kidney disease. And so this, we talked about this on a previous podcast, it reduced the risk of really bad kidney events, reduced the risk of heart events and deaths. In this trial, so this is really interesting because there was a 22% risk of retinopathy in each arm. There was no difference. So these are pretty high risk type 2 diabetes, heart disease, kidney disease type patients. And there was no real difference in the retinopathy. They did report eye disorders overall, and it was a hint more in the Ozempic group than placebo. It was 3 versus almost 2%, you know, not huge numbers or anything like that, but that was there. And then one other little study I want to mention, this is the SELECT trial. So this was obesity without diabetes, but with essentially established heart disease. There were 17,000 people in that trial, no diabetes. They didn't really mention retinopathy, but there was a 0.5% in each arm. So again, no real difference. In fact, it was exactly the same
placebo versus semaglutide who had an adverse eye event. So, you know, those are high risk. They have severe obesity. A lot of them have sleep apnea. They have heart disease. They're on blood pressure meds, but they don't have diabetes. And they didn't mention retinopathy, but they did mention eye events. So there's kind of the background of those are trials.
Let's ask Dr. Brueger what the difference is between a retinopathy and an NAION.
Yes.
Great question. So NAION is a hit directly, the hit being a blood flow that's you to the optic nerve itself. And ultimately with diabetic retinopathy, the small vasculature that is supplying blood and oxygen to our retina is greatly reduced. And that's because you get little microaneurysms, you can get ischemic events, similar to our neuropathies in our feet and why diabetics have difficulties healing wounds. Ultimately, the eye, which has a high metabolic demand because it's getting bombarded with all this light, it just isn't getting enough oxygen. So we release then a multitude of signals, the major one being vascular endothelial growth factor. That's the retina signal saying, hey, I need more oxygen, grow me new blood vessels. And that VEGF, vascular endothelial growth factor, then is making the vessels open. They start leaking and they're trying to grow new vessels, which they'll do. And then those can bleed and cause problems as well. The pericytes that go around our vasculature fall off and die in diabetes as well. So that is causing some leakage. So what we see in the retina is swelling or edema that is in the retina. We'll see hemorrhaging in the retina. And sometimes we'll start seeing new vessels growing all over the place. And this is where the diabetics are getting shots in their eyes of anti-VEGF. So it quite literally will bind with the VEGF that the retina is producing to try and calm down the retina and this drive to grow new blood vessels. And there's multiple drugs on the market. There's even now Ang-2 inhibitors for this angiogenesis or the growth of new vessels. So we have a lot of tools to use against this vascular drive, if you will. And, you know, that's kind of in the nuances of ophthalmology, all the treatments that we can do between like lasers, injections, and surgeries and those types of things to try and save people's visions. But a lot of that is driven by that VEGF. We'll see a cascade. It's interesting that you mentioned all those trials because when the one that really piqued my interest is the one about the obesity having the same incidence of ocular events. Mm-hmm. And you're like, what are you talking about? An ocular event? What's that? Right? You just need glasses or cataracts? What's going on? There's another category that I pull off of patients with blood pressure issues, and that is a vein occlusion. So the good Lord designed our eyeball where the artery, which is very thick and rigid, sits on top of the vein in our eye. And if your blood pressure is going high and is pressing on that vein, you'll have a vein occlusion. So blood can get into the retina, but it can't get back. Similarly, if you put a tourniquet on your arm, blood can potentially get into your arm, but can't get back out. So what would happen? Your arm would swell. You'd probably make it turn purple, the fingers would go numb, and you have this insult. But ultimately, we'll take the tourniquet off. But in the end, you say, hey, my hand doesn't feel right. My hand's cold all the time. Something isn't right. And that's right, because you had a blood flow problem. And that then makes the retina want to grow new blood vessels because it thinks it's not getting enough oxygen. We see swelling, we see bleeding in the eye. And they're treated with similar medications and similar injections in the eye. So I'm guessing that the individuals who are hypertensive and obese having a incident of some type probably had a vein occlusion, and that's where they're just kind of categorizing them into that kind of bucket, if you will. I doubt they had diabetic retinopathy because they didn't have diabetes. Mm-hmm. So you can't be categorized as diabetic retinopathy without diabetes, and that's kind of that spectrum, if you will, of like what NAION is, diabetic retinopathy, vein occlusions, and you can see they're all in this metabolic syndrome kind of spectrum as far as how is your blood flow.
So similar risk factors for each of them. However, like retinopathy is over time, whereas the NAION is like sudden.
Correct. That's sudden. And the vein occlusion is sudden as well. Because I have had a patients who are in their 30s. We can talk about this some other time, but they were using various energy drinks or other entities, and their blood pressure went up. And one that's most familiar was a fisherman I had. He was in his 30s. He was drinking about 3 or 4 Monsters a day. He was slightly overweight.
What other pressure was he doing that you mentioned?
No. Sometimes it's that. Sometimes it's like NO explode stuff, which we saw a lot in the Navy. People having. I remember Dr. Casey Nadolsky and I were sitting in morning rounds, and there was aortic dissections from like NO explode or something, and it was horrific. So all these things that are making the vasculature rigid and increasing your blood pressure. We'll see vein occlusions on these kids from high blood pressure. The NAION tends to be low blood pressure. And then the diabetes is just poor blood flow. It's equivalent to having very small strokes throughout the eye, little by little by little. And that's why we wind up with kidney disease, dementia, neuropathies. And that's why the diabetes can be so so profound as far as
So then I guess the media headlines now, because of this and because of this, you know, little signal, the retinopathy, and you've had the experience with the retinopathy, and it certainly concerns you as the man who deals with this stuff. But now, of course, all the headlines are saying, well, people are going blind by doing this new rare thing. Everyone's going blind. And it's like, holy cow, that's probably not the truth. But it sure seems like we need to prevent all these problems that are causing these and putting people at risk. And there's some plausibility.
The diabetic retinopathy entities is real. So in my training in residency, so this was 2013 to 2016, we knew that if people control their diabetes, their retinopathy went haywire.
Yeah.
So people would have a A1C of 12. And we're like, all right, we need to watch them very closely. We would even sometimes just treat them with injections because they have some edema, but we wouldn't necessarily let them go because as they're correcting it, I'm like, this is when you're going haywire. And time again, patients would be upset because they're like, my sugars are so much further now. Why are my eyes getting worse? And we said, it's a paradoxical shift. We just have to ride this wave and we can get you out. And that would be true. We would just have to do some injections, protect the eye, and eventually they would adjust. They're probably getting better blood flow and better oxygen to their eyes. So it doesn't know what to do with it because it's leaky vessels everywhere. Ultimately now, a patient actually brought it to my attention. She was started on Ozempic. She was one of my diabetic retinopathy patients. And all of a sudden her eye went haywire. And she didn't tell me what any changes. And I was like, oh my God, things are getting so much worse. We have to do injections and injections. And we went from like injections every couple months to every month we were doing a shot. I started doing laser in her eye. And finally, she came to me and she goes, hey, Dr. Brueger, I read that, you know, my Ozempic could be causing worsening of my diabetic retinopathy. I was like, what? No way. So went out, of course, looked it up, read about it, came back and said, you need to stop that right now. And she did. She stopped and she was able to reverse it. But sometimes there's still longstanding diabetic retinopathy and it looks different. After I've seen a bunch of them, they look different. And when I see one, I go, are you on some type of, you know, GLP-1? And then I had to learn Trulicity, Mounjaro, Ozempic. I mean, I have a list on my wall of all the different drugs so that going in, when I see how bad the retinopathy is, I know to ask those questions and then I so that they get off of it. And it's stiff because they're doing so well. They're like,
why does it look different?
It is like a volcano in their retina. It is all stretched out. It is fluffy. It is angry looking. It is the worst retinopathy you'll ever see.
And why does that happen?
I'm not sure. It is completely haywire.
The thoughts, I mean, you know, the prevailing thoughts were that it was
quickly corrected.
Because it's such a rapid improvement in blood sugar, weight, all that stuff.
But don't we see that with insulin?
We do see it with insulin.
But what I'm saying, he's saying,
but not to this degree.
Yeah,
no. I've seen him get worse, and you're like,
because there's so many other things. People are always trying to pontificate some of the things beyond what we truly, truly know as to why these medications are so good, and specifically semaglutide Ozempic for type 2 diabetes. And really, like I said, it was in that big cardiovascular outcome trial for Ozempic that really showed the signal. In the big cardiovascular kidney trial, it didn't show a difference in the two groups, but maybe people were better controlled going in. It was a more recent study. Something doesn't quite jive.
Okay, so but for retinopathy then, in order to minimize this risk, you would make sure people aren't correcting too quickly with their blood? How would
we do that in our clinic for
sure.
And
then Dr. Brueger, you said that you stop them, but then don't their blood sugars get worse, or what's going on?
They usually go back on whatever they were before. So if they're like on Lantus or something like that, then we would switch them back over to where they are controlled. What they like though is that the medication has less babysitting to it, and they were able to drop their weight so much. And you're like, oh, that's fantastic. Look, I'm making more progress quicker. And that's why the patients like that drug. But then we just switch them back to where they were controlled. So these are controlled diabetics, and now they're onto a different drug, and then they go haywire. So it's not that we necessarily are rapidly correcting their sugars. It's people who are already corrected, but switching for other benefits that we're seeing things worse as well.
And that wouldn't have anything to do with the blood pressure, because these are small.
Well, right. Good. I mean, maybe not, but right. They do improve their blood pressure pretty rapidly. Again, these are really small numbers, only, you know, really only signaled in the sustained, the semaglutide, the Ozempic trial,
right.
Not in the oral, not in the obesity without diabetes, but high risk cardiovascular disease. And then not in the flow trial, which was diabetes and kidney disease. So it's very, but then the other interesting thing, and then this is, you know, between, you know, we got ophthalmology, endocrinology, primary care, obesity medicine here. So there are so many other benefits. When people have retinopathy, that means they have such other extraordinary risks of heart disease, kidney disease, all these other things where they are getting. So in my world, we're getting people off their insulin using these medications because of all the other benefits. So then if this happens, and to be honest, I think I've had one or two patients. Because we know, again, but we think it's, or we historically thought it was the rapid improvements in sugar control. And we do that a lot. So we put people on these who have A1Cs of 14. I have a selection bias myself because those people are getting referred to me, right? So we're seeing the very severe patients. But I always talk about, hey, just be, you know, one, make sure you're seeing your eye doctor every year. So everyone needs to do that. Two, we should probably prevent this from ever becoming an issue. So if you're, let's prevent obesity, let's prevent type 2 diabetes, let's treat it early on. Because the other thing that they noted in these trials was people with diabetes for over 10 years that were associated with the potential risk of the retinopathy. And I don't know we're talking about retinopathy now, but and also older patients. So I guess in my world, I would say, wow, let's work with the ophthalmologist. But let's think about the benefits versus what can we do to prevent worsening of the retinopathy if this is a truly semaglutide specific thing somehow, because it's also not showing in the tirzepatide, which is Mounjaro trials that I'm aware of. Maybe it's because we don't have the big cardiovascular outcome trial yet, or maybe are they excluding people with that because of the sustained trial? I wonder. It's because everyone's concerned about it.
You would really need an ophthalmologist on these clinical trials to be watching these, because again, when we did a survey for the American Retina Society, what was interesting is that a lot of people said, no, we haven't seen this, but they're just categorizing it probably as just diabetic retinopathy. It's just a little bit worse, whatever, your sugars are better. But I think if we stand back and you look at it and you're like, here's someone who's controlled and is doing well, and then all of a sudden there's a shift, they're probably just like, oh, your sugars are better. That's what it is. But this is more profound. Mm-hmm. And I bet if we sat there, look at the imaging of the retina, did the measurements, you would probably find that there's actually a larger incident of it, saying that's the causation. And it becomes a little bit more important because it's harder to get control of sometimes. So once you get this, it's almost like an inflammatory change. Once that happens, it's tough to get it back under control. Another point, if anyone's over a 10 of A1C, I usually watch those eyes much more closely. You have a risk of going blind from fractional retinal detachments, hemorrhaging in the eye. And ultimately, if you have an A1C 10 or higher, I'm watching those individuals at least every 3 months. They're in stranger danger. 14, 15s. They probably are leaning into surgery sooner than later, and they need to be controlled. So, you know, we could talk a lot about diabetes and eyes.
Yeah, sure. We need to do a whole other thing on that, but
yeah,
exactly.
I was just going to say, just to make sure everybody's listening, we started the conversation talking about something called NAION, and it kind of got into this diabetic retinopathy. We talked about in the middle of the podcast the differences between the two. I think the practical takeaways from this are that, hey, this is a preliminary study. They need to look at other cohorts and actually look at this closer.
And look at all the trials that we're talking about.
The trials, the huge trials that we have, the SELECT trial, not the same population. Again, the study that we're talking about, it was a selection bias. These are people actually referred to these neuro-ophthalmologists. So people are actually having eye events. They try to do it as best as they could, looking back retrospectively, looking back in the past at this EMR data. Highly flawed, but I think they tried to do the best they can. There is biological plausibility. If you have blood pressure issues, if you already are on blood pressure medicine, work with your obesity specialist, your primary care doctor, whoever's prescribing the medicine, along with whoever's prescribing your blood pressure. Ideally, the same doctor would be doing both.
Or at least coordinating.
But ideally, someone would be doing both. But if you have high blood pressure already on these medicines and you start a GLP-1 receptor agonist, specifically semaglutide, we don't know if the signal is in tirzepatide or not. However, you get really good
weight reduction and blood pressure control on it. So
There's potentially, we can't say there's actually it's causal because of the way this study was done. There's potentially risk. There's biological plausibility. Make sure you watch your blood pressure quickly. If you have sleep apnea, you snore, risk factors, make sure you get that looked at. And then make sure you adjust your blood pressure medicines very quickly. Because I have some patients that even like, it's called orthostatic hypotension, they will get dizzy when standing up. And so we have to adjust their blood pressure medicines quickly. So ideally you'd have a at-home blood pressure monitor.
A lot of my patients do, but again, I have more severely ill patients, I guess.
The other thing to note is that these medicines are just, as we've talked about, we are shills for these medicines. We don't make money from big pharma. But these medicines have major improvements in cardiovascular disease and all sorts of quality of life. The risk, the absolute risk is very small. It wasn't even shown in any of the trials, but in this retrospective cohort where they looked specifically at those having eye issues, it was still a pretty small percent of the patients.
But so something we have to think about. And I guess
something we should consider.
Yeah. I mean, so from my perspective, I would say one, let's do all the things we need to do to prevent these problems, right? So primordial prevention, let's prevent, poor diet and exercise and obesity in the first place. If we have obesity, let's prevent the complications of that. So let's address the obesity. Let's treat earlier on, right? So let's deal with sleep apnea. Let's treat the obesity. Let's prevent diabetes and kidney disease. If you have type 2 diabetes, it's that early on. Let's treat it early on so you don't have the risk factors of not only this NAION, but the retinopathy. So the people who have diabetes, hyperglycemia for longer, the higher the glycemic problems, the higher the blood sugars for longer, the older age, all these things. If we treat these things early on, but then also have awareness, I think that there is something here, right? Let's not, the media is going to scare everyone away from all the benefits, but let's make sure everyone's seeing their eye doctors. Go see Dr. Brueger. So my patients with type 1 and type 2 diabetes, they know that you guys got to be seeing your eye doctors. And the worse your sugars are, the more frequently you better be seeing them, like you just said. And I hate to say it, but we have patients, who are struggling with high average sugars, A1Cs of 14, 15. So we got to address these earlier on.
The statistic on that one finally is that after 30 years, 95% of patients with diabetes, whether type 1 or type 2, 95% of people have some form of diabetic retinopathy. So I have patients beating themselves up about what their sugars were in the morning. Mm-hmm. And I was like, listen, you're paying the piper for 28 years of diabetes. All right. So imagine if you had a 28-year-old car. It's going to need some work. It's going to have some rust spots on it. And that's what we're taking care of and managing. So it's easy to get down on yourself like you're screwing things up and going into the spiral. But we just have to use all the information we have right now to make the best decisions we can.
And that's why we have Brueger on here.
Dr. Brueger, the greatest ophthalmologist in all the land.
The best there is, the best there was, and the best there ever will be.
If you have family members who are taking this medicine, friends, family members, worried about the blindness, and you know, want to talk about the NION, but also the retinopathy, make sure you share this podcast. Make sure you give us a few reviews, only if they're good. If you don't like it, you can anything else.
Well, go visit Dr. Brueger. You don't do a lot of the social media stuff to educate, but you do have some social media for your practice, I think, because I've seen that, and some educational materials online, right. I think,
to tell people.
So I'm building out BruegerRetina.com. So slowly just doing with some blogs and building that up. Hopefully I'll have my YouTube with some surgeries, because a lot of patients have questions about different surgeries, whether it's retinal detachments or floaters or what have you. And of course, I'm with the practice Carolina Eye Care, here established out of Charleston, South Carolina. So if anyone in the area needs an eye check, of course, I'm there for you.
Very cool. All right. Here's our outro.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.